Okay, give me a level.
All right, this is Jason Horsley for The Limitless talking to James Howard Kunstler. As you know, I like to keep things quite loose, so I don't have a very specific idea of what I was going to talk to you about today, except the starting point, which was, I hope it will be a starting point, which was the Areo, or Areo, however you pronounce it, website article that you sent me, Academic Grievance Studies and the Corruption of Scholarship. Which, yes, you sent me with an email titled, You'll Love This, and yeah. I guess it's true, I did. I didn't read the whole thing because it had an awful lot of case studies and whatnot, so I skimmed through that. But the gist of the... Do you want to sum up the gist of the piece, or shall I?
Well, why don't you have a go at it, and then, if you leave anything out, I'll see if I can add anything.
Okay, so I'll give it a shot. So it was three people at this university. Which university was it?
I don't remember.
Good point. Okay, well, one of these universities.
But they were academics. They were experienced academics.
And they wanted to do an experiment in terms of what kind of supposedly scholarly articles would, get past the gatekeepers and the peer reviews and whatnot, and to find out, how far they could prank or hoax it in the field of grievance studies. So they came up with a whole bunch of seemingly overtly absurd theses that pertain to this field of grievance studies that basically hit all the right points in terms of political correctness and, social justice warrior ethics. And they found that no matter how absurd they got with their theses, their pieces were being accepted and praised and peer-reviewed and so on and so forth. So anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think we ought to describe what some of the titles were in the abstracts, because they're really quite funny, and I don't happen to have the screen in front of me.
Okay, so I got it here. Dog Park was one.
Yeah, and that was all about demonstrating that dog parks are dog rape arenas, and that mm-hmm. they in some way are designed to transmit the idea that rape is okay to the men who take their dogs to the park and watch their dogs humping other dogs.
Right, and then the thesis was supposed to provide insight into training men out of the sexual violence and bigotry to which they are prone. The purpose of it is written to see if journals will accept arguments which should be clearly ludicrous and unethical if they provide an unfalsifiable way to perpetuate notions of toxic masculinity, heteronormativity, and implicit bias. So that was one. Fat bodybuilding was another. Who are they to judge? That was a thesis about it's only oppressive cultural norms which make society regard the building of muscle rather than fat admirable. And that bodybuilding and activism on behalf of the fat could be benefited by including fat bodies displayed in non-competitive ways.
And by the way, it should be obvious that if you employ enough of the current jargon, the popular jargon, just about any nonsense will get through. And, one of the key words these days is the word bodies. And I think that was actually originally popularized by Ta-Nehisi Coates in his book. I forget the title. But his constant reference to black bodies being transgressed by what the white heteronormative patriarchy.
Mm. So you're saying that there are these buzzwords that serve as thought stoppers. it seems as though, as you're saying, there are certain words that have been recontextualized ideologically so that once they appear in a thesis or whatever, has got this sort of ideological zip file that opens up in the consciousness of the reader, and they basically can't think about anything except that.
Oh, yeah.
That, yeah.
By the way, many, many years ago, when I was a young freelance writer in Boston, writing for the Boston hippie newspapers, I got a job at a place called Term Papers Unlimited. And they manufactured term papers for the many college students of the Boston area. And you really got the hang of how to bullshit your way through any assignment by just flinging as much padded jargon on the at the typewriter as possible. So this is the kind of thing I recognize, from going way back.
And so what was your goal and purpose then? Was it just to get published and make some money, or were you
No, it
did
was
you have an
twofold.
ideological thrust?
No, it wasn't ideological at all, really. I had two purposes. One was I was barely making a living, writing freelance articles for the Boston Phoenix. So I needed a gig. But the other thing was I wanted to write about this because it was so bizarre. And it turned out to be an extremely bizarre kind of working environment. It was Term Papers Unlimited was this joint on Huntington Avenue, about a block from Northeastern University. And they had their system was they had a big manifest board in the lobby. It wasn't a lobby, it was just a front room, let's call it, of a broken down second floor office suite over the Hayes Bickford cafeteria. And so in the front room, they had this big kind of desk set up with a list of all the topics that the freelance term paper writers could pick. And then there was another room off of that called the tank where we worked. And the tank was the room where we wrote all the papers that the freelancers didn't want or were too difficult for them.
Right.
And so there were about seven or eight of us in this room called the tank, and all of these people were completely out of their minds. I mean, if you can imagine living in a working environment that was like being in finals week forever with no end to it. The only time that our papers actually got rejected by the quality control guy, they had a quality control guy there named Dale. He was like one of the two or three people who actually worked, ran the company. The only time Dale rejected the papers was when we got a coffee ring on the front page or spilled ketchup on it.
Right.
So I wrote papers like American, let's see, French Attitudes to the American Civil War was one that I wrote. I wrote one on race relations at the University of Kentucky, based on about three college newspapers that the guy sent me. I don't know. It was pretty funny. We were writing everything from freshman work to doctoral dissertations, and they paid us by the page. And the rate at the time was something like $2 a page for first 2 year undergraduate papers, and then 250 for the junior and senior papers, and I don't know, $3 or 350 for master's theses, and 450 for doctoral dissertations. Now, there was a guy in there who was writing dissertations for the Navy War College. That was the kind of stuff we did, and they ended up getting busted. Before I left Boston, they had these hearings in the state legislature about this activity because two kids at Harvard handed in identical term papers, and they discovered that they came from Term Papers Unlimited. And by the way, we had a competitor across the river in Cambridge called Bullshit Unlimited, and we were both selling papers. So they hauled the owners of these two establishments into the state legislature and grilled them, and they eventually put them out of business by legislating against that. But the funny part was when they testified in the state legislature about what they were selling, they said, "Well, we sell research materials that come in a form that resembles a term paper." So that was kind of a yuck. But, you know, working there really kind of clued me into the whole process of how bullshit is constructed. And
So,
so I recognize it in this new manifestation of it.
And you said that you'd taken that work not just for financial income, but as an experiment or as a way to get to know
No,
better that milieu.
I ended up writing a piece about it for the Boston Phoenix. And
Oh.
I think I only lasted there about 3 months, maybe. It was punishing work. If you can imagine going to a place where you have to write term papers all day. They also made us write a minimum of 50 pages a week in the tank. You know, if you couldn't put that out, you couldn't stay in the tank.
Right. So you'd gone into it knowing that you were going to write a piece about it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Right. So you were undercover, effectively.
Yeah, pretty much. But
So
I
how
actually
would.
did do the work, you know. I mean, I had to do the work, and besides, I was getting paid. I, you know, for the only time that I of the year that I spent in Boston doing that kind of work, that was really the only time that I was making enough money to really live on.
And when was that?
1972, the
Wow,
spring
okay.
of.
So 50 years ago.
Amazingly long ago, and amazing that I can even remember that I have enough, you know, brain cells left to remember it.
And how would you compare then what you do remember of that experience to this piece of area? Like how far have things degenerated, would you say, or evolved or progressed or whatever word we
Yeah,
would
I don't think
use?
they've degenerated. I think they've evolved really only in the sense that the jargon of academia has become much more elaborate and baroque, you know, and kind of fixed in place for the last, you know, 10, 20 years or so. And at the time, the French post-structuralists were just, you know, getting underway or really, really getting out there. So it hadn't quite infected the departments, and they hadn't driven themselves mad with this stuff. So, you know, you were dealing with an earlier generation of professors who, you know, were less attuned to jargon and more attuned to actually discursive writing that made sense. But we were able to, you know, shove this stuff through. By the way, we never found out what kind of grades we got. You know, it was not part of the deal with the client. And we didn't really care whether they passed or failed. We just sold them this package of stuff, you know, that came this term paper that you know, was research material that resembled a term paper.
But while you were writing them, you were aware of trying to use the jargon. Was that also trying to give the right ideological slant to the pieces?
Well, no, there wasn't a whole lot of ideology involved. It was mostly a matter of just, you know, using the longest words possible and as many of them to cram as many words in there so that you could just, you know, finish the darn thing and get on with the next project and make some more money. So
Right.
it was more a matter of quantity than quality. But it had to appear to make enough sense to get through.
Yeah.
But that was it. You know, it only had to appear to make sense. And that was the basic resemblance between what we did then and what you're seeing now with this stuff. But of
Yeah.
course, there's a whole agenda attached to the current situation that wasn't there before. We were just trying to make a buck. And the kids who were buying the papers were only trying to get, you know, pass their courses. They weren't trying to fit into a social justice template of you know, belief in ideology.
Do you think you can trace a relationship, though, between the predominance, the prevalence of jargon-based theses and what we're seeing now, which, as I say, it's the words are more like buzzwords. It's still jargon, but it's less to do with a kind of intellectual obfuscation and more to do with a triggering of the right emotional responses.
Yeah, and I dare say that intellectual fraud has a long and distinguished history, and you know, there's always been intellectual fraud, and there are there are people who have been very good at it, and the story continues. I think the situation today has much more to do with the degeneration of education per se than the fact that there are intellectual fraudsters out there per se. And the state of education. I don't teach in the college. I'm not a professor. I haven't been really involved in academia since I left it, but I've done a lot of lecturing at hundreds of colleges around the country, so I've certainly seen them, and I've met the faculty and consorted with the students. I just don't have any responsibility toward an institution, which is fine by me, because it seems to have become a dreadful scene out there.
Well, yeah, let's zero in on that because I wanted to get to this. And if there's anything you don't want to talk about, we'll just edit it out or you can just say so. But in terms of our respective personal experiences in this current climate of ideological censorship or whatever you call it, it's kind of a soft form of censorship of control. And what's your experience of speaking at universities or just generally being a communicator, have you felt that you've had less and less freedom to express yourself, or that what you have been expressing has been less and less welcome within certain climates?
Oh dear, what a question. You can actually draw a kind of, I guess, a logarithmic arc that goes downhill. Is that the proper term? What happened was, for many years, I was lecturing at universities after the Geography of Nowhere book came out around 1993. That's going back quite a bit now, 25 years. And I was circulating around the university scene for decades, and things were pretty good. Everything was fine. I was giving my spiels and trying to put across ideas about the economy, combined with ideas of how we inhabit the landscape and design the human habitat around us. And then I published The Long Emergency and a few other books along the way. And The Long Emergency came out in 2005. And I was lecturing about that. And my talk started to morph more in the direction of political and economic and cultural collapse. Although the question of how we constructed the human habitat was still a big part of it, because I think it remains a very important part of the equation, the fact that we're living in all these dreadful places that have no future. But there was a very sharp break around 2012 or so. Things really started to change. And what changed was that the students and the faculty, of course, started to become extremely intolerant of some of the ideas that I was putting across. And I think there was a kind of a pivotal moment when I showed a PowerPoint image of a kid who, I guess the term at the time was a personal presentation of a person called a Wigger, which was a white kid trying to pretend he was a rap star. And I was using an image of a kid dressed in one of those costumes to make a point. And the point I was making was, the kid in the photo is wearing a sideways hat and his shoelaces, he doesn't have shoelaces, and his pants are hanging down below his ass crack, and his shirt was hanging down really long, so it looked like he had a very, very big torso and very, very short legs, right? And I was trying to make the point that young men were presenting themselves as 4-year-olds physically and in the costume of 4-year-olds. And that really, the kids in the audience really got angry about that. And that was my first really vivid encounter with the kind of with a kind of emotion that was roiling around in the student body. And I encountered more and more of that in the next year or so. And then in 2015, I had an incident at Boston College where this woman professor who did not attend my my lecture sent out a bunch of tweets and Facebook things the day after denouncing me. She hadn't been there, but, you know, she heard about it. And, you know, that was my first encounter with really getting attacked in social media.
Trashed on Twitter. What did she denounce you as?
Well, here's the background of what happened. I don't know if this is an interesting story or what, but I'll tell you. I went and gave my lecture at Boston College. And Boston College, by the way, is a, you know, a Catholic, originally a Catholic university, and still, you know, I think associated with the Catholic Church in one way or another. So I gave my lecture, and after that, about 6 or 7 faculty members went out to dinner with me at a restaurant in Brookline. And 3 of them were literature professors who specialized in gender studies. And we started talking about race and gender. And I made this remark that I thought that the primary mission of secondary education for black kids in the ghetto should be to, first of all, teach people how to speak English properly and write in English properly. And that if they didn't do that, the kids would probably be unlikely to learn other stuff like math and science. And that it was terribly important. And they reacted with rage and started denouncing me across the table as being a racist. And, it kind of shocked me. But my response was to challenge them, really, and say, well, okay, how and why would you mount an argument against teaching the English language, which is the primary language of this culture, and doing it correctly? And they really couldn't answer me. I mean, they were so caught up in this fugue of rage that the whole dinner came to sort of a crashing end. And so this black faculty lady heard about it the next day and denounced me on Twitter and Facebook. But I still, to this day, wonder, you know, what is unsound about that idea? You know, we've got a whole kind of subgroup in the population of people who are struggling. And I believe one of the reasons they're struggling is because they don't have the language skills that other groups in the United States have. And they're certainly capable of developing it. But, you know, we're not interested in doing that. And the fact that we're not interested in doing that says a lot about how misguided we actually are.
So you got hit with the R word, I'm presuming.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure.
And did it stick in any way? Were there consequences to that? Would you say?
Well, it's hard to tell, except that after that, I got very few college campus bookings for lectures. And my lecture agent told me at the time that she was having problems with many of her authors. And so I didn't feel particularly singled out. I just felt like I was part of a wave of people who were kind of being frozen out of the system.
Sure.
So yeah. I didn't feel that I was being picked on, especially in that way. Or although I would grant you that I probably had a reputation for presenting somewhat harsh material that would challenge people.
Yeah.
But the emotional climate on the campus was changing in the direction of tremendous intolerance to ideas of any kind. So, you know, you get a guy who's presenting ideas that are difficult to digest in that rising climate of intolerance, and it's a pretty bad recipe. So,
right, because you're saying they're already making them uncomfortable. They're already trying to find a way to kill the messenger, and so then they're looking for the first possible, unconsciously, I would say, justification to actually banish you to the wilderness like the proverbial goat.
And, I don't want to be a crybaby about it because, you know, it's just tough shit for me. But it does say something about the direction that our culture has gone in.
Yeah, well, it does, and that's why I want to linger on it. I mean, I think the story has interest in and of itself as an anecdote, but as obviously it's part of this larger context, and it can be tricky in terms of one doesn't want to be complaining about the way one is treated, but and then be kind of joining the victim culture in that way. A bit of a catch-22 there, but as anthropological evidence, let's say, or sociological evidence of an agenda being pushed, I find it very relevant. I've had, certainly not on the same scale, it hasn't interfered with my income because I never made money off writing books anyway, but with Prisoner Infinity, which is absolutely not about anything, that would set off the alarm bells of the social justice warrior faction. It's about alien abduction and mind control and trauma and whatnot. But it certainly could be seen as threatening in the same way that your material is to the sort of dominant narrative about this wonderful world that we live in. And I found with that book, something similar happened there, and I can't really name names, unfortunately, but it was somebody that had read and appreciated the book very much, was writing for a fairly mainstream periodical, I mean, relatively, for me anyway, and he wrote a review for it, and it got put up at the site for about 2 hours or something, and then it disappeared. And he spent 2 weeks trying to find out what had happened to it, and he just couldn't get an answer. And I guess another 2 weeks went by or something. Eventually, it was published, but only when he pushed for it. And it turned out that the editor of that journal had done his research and found my article on transgender and become convinced that I represented the alt-right, and therefore, basically, I shouldn't have my books promoted. I think I don't want to join too many dots, but I don't think I'm doing that. I mean, that was essentially I was guilty by association. I'd written this other unrelated piece, and therefore I had to be, I had to be,
Silenced.
well, I had to be grouped with a certain faction that was seen as the enemy, and therefore,
But
there was a larger cause.
what you're describing is the role of a commissar, in the sense of this, what this, how this editor behaved. They've become commissars.
Yeah, that's why I say there's a greater cause in quotes. Like this, I'm pretty sure this person believed that there's this invisible threat. It's like a new kind of terrorism, emotional terrorism, and that it had to be fought, wherever it appeared, and so he had to be constantly vigilant, and that was part of his job. And yeah, he saw that this was a possible way that the evil, toxic virus might creep through his carefully constructed filters, protecting the world
I
from
don't
dangerous
actually,
knowledge.
I wouldn't assume that he really believed any of that any more than a Soviet commissar in 1964 believed in the censoring that he was doing. It seems to me to be equally plausible that, you get in a situation where you're stuck in a swamp of groupthink, and if you fail to go along with it, I mean, your job security's at stake, your career's at stake. Careers are being made and broken by this kind of stuff. And in fact, I think that the biggest story that's not actually being discussed, it's just not in the arena, is the whole question of the status and prestige that's associated with all of this nuttiness, that people actually get tremendous status, prestige, and career advancement from subscribing or even pretending to subscribe to these ideas. So the dishonesty in it, I think, is enormous and unreckoned. I don't think that we have really gotten a hold on how completely mendacious this behavior is.
Well, this we touched on in our previous conversation, didn't we, with the problem with determining honesty from dishonesty when there's the invisible line between conscious and unconscious, as in when is a person consciously behaving in a way for their own advantage and pretending to believe things they don't, and when is a person unconsciously, choosing to believe things because it will advance their career.
Well, there's one of the reasons that you develop ideologies and cant is so that there's always some kind of easily accessible module of language that you can employ in either attacking your enemies or defending yourself. And you don't necessarily have to believe these things, you just have to remember them and then spout them. And to some extent, they're either weapons or they're defensive strategies,
Offensive or
but they're not
defensive.
real ideas.
Yeah, well, I mean, is it how far do you think this is from the sophists of ancient Greece and this whole I mean, how sincere were the sophists, you'd say? I don't know if it's an area you've looked into. I haven't looked into it much, but this basic idea of trying to win an argument and of using arguments and and logic and ideas and whatnot, simply to win the argument rather than actually to get to the truth. That seems like a pretty old, long-standing tradition that's always been disreputable, I guess. Or, I mean, were the sophists, did they have any reputation? No, they must have done
I wish I
at the
could
time.
speak intelligently about classical literature, and it's kind of beyond my education. But as we said not very few minutes ago, intellectual dishonesty is not a new thing in this world. And when you go back to Greece, you're really only going back to the first recorded instances of it. And the early instances of identifying it as such in a formal way, so that the Greeks could point to the sophists and say, "Oh, that's how you do this dishonestly. That's how you engage in discourse dishonestly."
Yeah, watch out for that, and also watch out for it in oneself, because sophistry is something that one can resort to unconsciously. Like, we all have a part of us that wants to win the argument, you know.
Sure.
So bringing it back to the aria piece, then, I mean, what you've been talking about is a dead match, really. There with people, I mean, what they put to the test is, you know, can we bullshit our way through these theses in a way that will advance our careers, or would if we were actually trying to do that? And they show that they could.
Yeah, for the
But
most
this
part, they
is,
succeeded.
yeah. So this is a testable method for advancing your career within academia, is to basically stick to this ideological narrative, if we can call it that.
So the question becomes, how did the university become so contaminated with this formalized, systematic dishonesty? That to me is the interesting question. And the related question, which we touched on in an earlier podcast, was the amazing failure of authority in the people who are supposedly in charge in these institutions, namely the department chairs, the deans, the presidents, who go along with this nonsense, or in some cases even promulgate it.
Well, yes, that's where I was getting with the commissar. What level is the commissar, by the way, just to get my metaphors right here?
Oh,
How
I
high
think
up is the
they're
commissar?
in the sense that we're talking about, the people who, the sub-editors who vet articles for academic journals,
Yeah.
it's a pretty low level.
Right, so
It's just
that's the
some schmuck at
commissar.
a it's just some schmuck at a state university somewhere in Nebraska, or or Cambridge, England, or but they're gatekeepers of a low order, and they do what they feel they have to do to keep their jobs and keep their status and keep rolling the hoop of the ideology that they're in the service of.
Right. So yeah, there's two points I'd like to explore around that. One is he's saying they don't have to believe it in order to, you know, to keep to it, because they just have to want to keep their job. But it's worth considering that it's probably easier to do their job if they can convince themselves to believe it, you know, because it'd be so soul destroying. So there's that. They may end up believing it just because they have to keep saying and acting as if they
I
believe
think
it.
the language itself enables them to believe it, because it dresses up these thoughts with exactly the kind of academic respectability that has so much value in the institution. And so you just cover these bad ideas with the trappings of intellectual respectability, and it's very easy to fool yourself and others that they have meaning and value.
Well, and there's the added dimension of moral, what would we call it exactly? I mean, it's moralism essentially, that these are the right positions or the right points of view, even if they're not factually true, they're morally correct.
Well, another thing that we touched on in an earlier conversation was that idea that Eric Weinstein touched on, and he said that the safe spaces that were created in the universities over the last several years were not created to protect the students. They were there to protect the narratives of the cult of the university. and especially the cult of diversity, multiculturalism, and all of its handmaidens and fellow travelers. So it was the narrative that needed to be protected because it was so fragile, because it was so palpably idiotic, and needed to be protected from reason. And along those lines, you can extrapolate that a little bit and come to the conclusion that the university itself is a cult enterprise, or has become that.
Yeah, because I mean the narrative. I mean cults always revolve around narratives. I mean cults in the conventional sense or in the profane sense, as in they're usually religious and they usually have a leader, and they have a narrative. Scientology is a very good example. It's a very elaborate narrative. If you're going to become a Scientologist, you find out about the narrative little by little, and you've got to learn the tenets and you believe in them, right? And then you act, you live your life, and you act and you interact with others in a way that protects and extends the narrative, right?
And the penalty for betraying the narrative is almost always very severe in any kind of occult situation. So that alone tells you how highly is valued.
Yeah, so it seems as though, I mean, we can sort of trace I don't know what it would be, actually, as I'm not really visually oriented, but you've got the narrative, and somehow the narrative's more easy to identify through the ideology and through the opinions and things that are being protected and being promoted and propagated. Even as you say, by people who don't necessarily believe in them, but their survival depends on protecting that narrative. But they do issue from individuals within an institution, which is the university, which is also nested within the state.
Right, but you know, you can see very clearly how insane some of these ideas are. Just the fundamental idea that I think has been established in this struggle of the last several years, it's because it comes up constantly, it's unavoidable, is the notion that diversity means shutting down conversation and discussion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, what could be more logically incoherent?
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have college presidents and deans who support that unbelievably and fundamentally incoherent idea.
Right.
So that's what informs you that either the system is extremely dishonest or extremely insane.
Yeah, or possibly both.
Yeah.
I suppose they're not mutually exclusive, are they? So, but I mean, with the analogy of the commissar and the state, you know, the totalitarian state, at a certain level, if you go high enough up, and of course one has to speculate because one doesn't have access to those inner workings, but one can speculate that at the higher levels of this state, you know, system that's creating the narrative, or at least kind of sowing the seed of it that then gets created, there is an awareness that this narrative is contradictory, that is insane, but it's a necessary narrative, it's necessary propaganda in order to maintain the working order of the state.
I haven't seen any evidence that that's true. I haven't seen any evidence that the people in authority in these places actually recognize the mendacity that they're trading in and trafficking in. In fact, you know, one of the signal examples of that occurred this week when a press release went out from Harvard saying that the retiring president of Harvard, Drew Faust, a woman of about 70, will be joining the staff of Goldman Sachs.
Her name is Faust?
Faust, yeah, that's a curious detail.
Okay.
She was the person who replaced Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary who became president of Harvard after he was a cabinet member. And he infamously said at a luncheon one time that perhaps we could account for differences between the performance of men and women in the science and engineering and math fields by some difference in the way the different sexes processed, cognitively processed information. And that was such a terrible idea that he put out there that he was forced to resign over it.
Right. So bring it back to this question then, of mendacity and how conscious it is or not. You were saying that with the editor that I mentioned, you saw no reason to think that he believed that, but he was just serving his interests and, knowing what the higher-ups wanted from him. So then does that mean that you think that the lower you go down the totem pole, the less people believe in the narrative?
Well, it's possible. I would just, it's hard to really figure that out. All I can say is that probably everybody involved in this stuff knows what's at stake. And when you clear away all the bullshit, probably what's at stake is their, their careers. So it's careerism in the same way that advancing in the Soviet Communist Party was careerism. You had to behave as though you agreed with what everybody else was doing and pretending to believe in.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to know is how many people actually know that they're pretending to believe this crap.
Right. Well, yes, and of course that's a delicate thing, because if you suggest it to somebody who's in front of you, they might not like it, right?
No, it's such an important... it's an absolutely critical part of your life. How are you going to have a career? How are you going to feed yourself? How are you going to make a buck? How are you going to support your family?
Well, I think it maybe even goes even deeper, because if they have an identity that's it isn't constructed around that, because their identity came about much earlier on, but it's become dependent on an ideology. So then if you take away their conviction, or if they feel their conviction beginning to crumble around their narrative, then the whole sense of who they are could become unmoored.
Well, that's an interesting point, and it would be very interesting to see how many students and graduate assistants and faculty people had actually been driven mad by the demands of having to be consistently dishonest with themselves and other people. I imagine there are some people who are having quite a hard time with that and functioning pretty poorly because of it. But I also think that, this stuff, because this stuff is so unreal and insane, I don't think it's going to go on that long. It's really a pretty classic hysteria.
Well, yeah, and there's... there do seem to be growing examples. Lindsay Shepherd comes to mind. She was the woman who taught in a Canadian university and just showed a footage of Jordan Peterson just for discussion, and she was accused of being a transphobe.
Yeah.
just because she'd shown some footage, and she got excoriated and vilified, and she stood up for it. And,
well, let's talk about that process for a second.
Yeah.
It's important to point out that what happened to her was exactly what I'm talking about, the failure of authority. She was brought up in front of the authorities and hassled about this and threatened with, her career was threatened very dishonestly by people who should have known better. The people who were supposedly, in charge of her job, or the people who were supervising her.
Yeah.
So they behaved with obvious dishonesty, and I'm sure it thunders up the line, I'm still amazed and baffled that the people way above those intermediate managers, the department chairs, I'm amazed that the deans don't get into trouble about this, or are not discovered to be behaving very dishonestly.
It seemed impossible.
We can probably confidently state that if you stay low enough down, as you're saying about the editor and Lindsay Shepherd, if they step out of line, their job is under threat. So it's not hard to imagine that the people who took Shepherd aside and were berating her incoherently, unbeknownst, not realizing they were being recorded and they would be exposed in their asinine behavior, they felt they were protecting their jobs too. Let's say, because they didn't know, this is everything's so liminal, everything's so unstable now in terms of what is acceptable and what isn't, that Jordan Peterson, obviously a massive controversy there. Oh, one of our teachers has actually shown, students might get triggered. We could have lawsuits. Yeah, everything's so volatile. Let's just say, give them benefit of the doubt, they weren't acting in this Machiavellian, mendacious way. They just thought, I could lose my job for what this person has done, so I better get her in line. Right? So, but then you go, no, another level up, and you've got the deans or whatever, and they, well, we don't have to go into the whole specifics of that narrative, but how. At a certain point, we don't know who to refer to, do we, in terms of who's above that person and whether they're being consciously mendacious or not?
Well, we don't know for sure whether they believe this, believe this bullshit or not, but we do know who they are, and we do know that they're not doing anything about it, and that they're in many cases they're taking actions that are very damaging to people involved. I don't remember exactly how this played out, but you had this crazy woman at Columbia University who had a consensual sex relationship with a guy, and she ended up accusing him of rape, even after she had re they had recordings of their phone exchanges or their tweets or their emails. I don't remember which one, about how they were behaving towards each other after this consensual act. And they both behaved as though they understood that they had sex, and it was what it was. And then this woman turns around, accuses this guy of rape. And so what does Lee Bollinger, the president of Columbia University, do about this when it's discovered that there's actually evidence that shows that she's faking it? He does absolutely nothing. And so Columbia University gets sued. I don't know what the disposition of that lawsuit is, but it was quite a while ago. This was the famous mattress girl case, the girl who, in order to demonstrate how damaged she was, she undertook to carry a mattress around the campus with her for the following 3 years that she was a student there. So she's hauling this mattress around like she's Jesus Christ carrying a cross, and making a spectacle of herself. And the whole thing was fake. And the young man involved ended up suing the university.
Right.
So my point is,
Yeah.
look, how many deans and people in authority are there at Columbia University? I dare say there are lots of them, dozens, scores of them. And who stood up and said, this is wrong? Who stood up and said, we cannot have kangaroo courts anymore? We just can't keep on behaving this way. It's like some kind of medieval witch hunting star chamber. But nobody did. And I think all across the country, I don't see any evidence that anybody stood up to any of this except one guy, the president of the University of Chicago, who put out a kind of a policy declaration 2 or 3 years ago saying we are a campus of free speech and we're not going to shut down free speech. He didn't go a whole lot further. He kind of drew the line and that was it. But all around the country, there are hundreds and hundreds of colleges where nobody stands up, nobody speaks up. They've all become hostages to really a period of an historical period of craziness. Now, what might be more fruitful to talk about or wonder about is why this hysteria has taken place. And I would submit that it's happening because, first of all, of the degeneracy of higher ed in general, the fact that it's become a racketeering operation. And in the United States, it became deeply tied into the college loan racket, which was to a large degree promoted by government backing of college loans. You know, when that changed, when the government about, I don't remember how many years ago it was. It might have been like 5, might have been 7 years ago. I forget. But when they decided that that they had to step in and guarantee the performance of the loans the same way that they guaranteed mortgages, that's when college tuition and fees started to rise tremendously. And that's when they started hiring all of these diversity deans, whose job, by the way, really is to just manufacture more hysteria. And, you know, that's when college became kind of just an overtly pay for credentialing racket. Where it remains today.
How long of a period did that take for that
transformation? I dare say that it's happened over the last decade.
Wow.
And you know, and it's just gotten to the point where the people who run the colleges, the deans and the presidents and the financial officers understand that you know, they're running these companies that depend on a certain financial equation. And they've made all kinds of really bad choices, like overbuilding their facilities, you know, putting up build new buildings that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. In some cases, you know, to teach things that have absolutely no value in the economy, like gender studies. So they're stuck on that kind of wheel. And so I think the system has become tremendously dishonest and degenerate. And they're kind of hostages to their own dishonesty.
Yeah, this is very interesting. I mean, it's something I've been sort of trying to explore recently in terms of how much of the degeneration of society and the dehumanization that seems to be going on in society can be traced to the monetary system in itself. I'm not an economist or, you know, Marxist or anything like that. I'm a person who is always looking for this unified conspiracy theory of history in a certain sense, so hopefully in a legitimate way. It just has occurred to me many times how if you look at an institution, we're talking about the university system now, but you could also apply it to the medical institutions as well, that the more that profit becomes the determining factor and the motivational factor, the more that institution becomes the inverse of what it's supposed to be. So a very easy example, the medical institute or establishment, it makes profit off sick people. Therefore, it's not strictly in its interest to make people healthy.
Yeah.
So then it can actually start to appear like a conspiracy.
I think there's a missing link there, though. It's not merely the fact that these enterprises are profit seeking, or that they, you know, that it takes money to run them, and the money has to come from somewhere. It's more a matter of they've become rackets. And it's very important for people to understand that capitalism is not the same as racketeering. First of all, you know, I would go as far to say that capitalism is not really even an ism. It's misunderstood as an ideology. Capitalism is simply the way that societies manage surplus wealth. And all societies are capable of generating surplus wealth of some kind, whether it's, you know, one extra bushel of peas or $100 million in some kind of a financial certificate. You know, it's still surplus wealth. And capitalism is about managing surplus wealth. And I'd also make a distinction between, you know, monetary issues and just economies. Human beings are social animals, and we have economies, meaning we have ways to keep ourselves alive and allow us to thrive. And in an especially complex one, it involves this thing called money. But money is not the be-all and end-all of it. The be-all and end-all of it is actually having activities that people can do that keep them occupied and give them a livelihood and give them a place both vocationally and socially and economically. So, you know, the whole issue of capitalism, I think, is kind of a red herring. It's really a question of whether you're doing business honestly or whether you're running a racket. Right. And the essence of being a racket is that it is dishonest money getting.
Right.
Because there's nothing, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong per se with expecting to get paid for something or to you know, to benefit from some work that you're doing. But it's quite another thing to systematize and legitimize the practice of getting money dishonestly. And that's exactly what has happened to medicine and education in the USA. Medicine is arguably even more dishonest than education, because there's almost no intellectual veneer over its activities. I mean, either, you know, they're actually doing operations or you know, interviewing patients or prescribing things. But they're not as afflicted by ideology, unless it's the ideology of what they call the standards of practice, meaning, for example, whatever medical authorities there are in the U.S. put out standards of practice that say you must treat a high lipid level with statin drugs, and if you don't do it, you won't get reimbursed by the insurance companies.
Right.
Right. That's pretty much where the ideology begins and ends. It's no more elaborate than that. But the actual dishonest money grubbing, I got a bill from the cardiologist the last week. Well, it was a statement from the insurance company. I go in every year for like a 10-minute interview with the cardiologist. I chat with him for 10 minutes. He listens to my chest with a stethoscope for about 30 seconds, and that's it. I got a statement this week that said he charged them $500 for that, you know. And if you figure that's a 10-minute interview and, you know, he does six of them an hour, so he's making $3,000 an hour, you know, which I think is probably a pretty dishonest amount of money grubbing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how many medical specialists are there like him around the country who are doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it comes back to the point you were saying about how people might be becoming insane because they're having to adhere to dishonest principles or adhere to things that they basically know are false.
Now, I think that doctors can actually be prone to going more insane than the educators, because the educators can take refuge in their elaborate labyrinths of linguistic bullshit to hide in. Right. They can hide behind all that. And also because in education, when all said and done, there's very little at stake. I mean, no one's going to die because, you know, they fail their gender studies test.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more at stake in medicine. And my observation is that the doctors that I see and the doctors I know as friends are profoundly unhappy about how all this stuff is shaken out. And a lot of them don't want to be doctors anymore. They certainly don't want to work in these giant American family practices, you know, where they have 10 doctors and they're in a building with 60 people because they need 50 more people to just manage the paperwork or the computerized billing and all that stuff. You know, at my doctor's office, and by the way, I live in upstate New York in a fairly rural part of the country. And this doctor's office is like the motor vehicle bureau. They have 10 corrals in the waiting room for their, you know, for the people to sit and process the patient's paperwork when they come in.
Mm.
So, I mean, you can just see it in the physical setup. And then they're running these people through the doctor's offices like cattle through like sheep through a sheep dipping operation.
Mm. Yeah, so that, I mean, one of the things that people need more than anything, whether they're sick or not, but especially if they're sick, is a human connection, a feeling of being heard and received. And, you know, it's not like the doctor's supposed to be some miracle worker or anything, but you would hope that he'd have some, really felt present human connection to his patients, a relationship with them,
And they don't
where they
get that, by the way, because they're when you go in there, you may have had this experience up in Canada, but when you go in there, they're just looking at their laptop screen. They're not looking at you. They're not even touching you. You don't take off your clothes. They don't want to see your body. It's just amazing.
Well, they're probably embarrassed to look their patients in the eye at this point.
Well, that may be one of the reasons they do it. The other reason they do it, of course, is because they have to check all these boxes in the computer program to satisfy the insurers that they're checking all the boxes. So that's what they're doing. But, the whole system is completely nuts.
Well, that was where I was going actually with this economic model, which, as I say, I don't have the background in economy to really map it out as yet. But it seems as though one can trace the kind of computerization of human interactions and institutions and the rest of it from the economic system. There seems to be a kind of spectrum there, as in everything is becoming more about quantities, ticking boxes, meeting the financial requirements. Everything gets compartmentalized in that way, and everything gets further and further away from just a lived human connection, like the architecture you're talking about. A lot of that architecture, probably primarily, one of the reasons it's so ugly is that that's presumably economically more viable. That's they cut corners now economically, so they're not human beings making human decisions for human reasons anymore.
No, I think what you're also seeing, or what you're describing, are the diminishing returns of technology, which is a hugely underappreciated part of the world that we're living in now. That the computerization of everything has a lot of unintended consequences, and mainly tends to lead to making a lot of things worse. But we're so dazzled by our techno narcissism that we haven't gotten to the point where we can even accept the fact that this is going on.
Well, I think one of the ways it's making things worse, and this is just something to say about technology, when it's really effective, it becomes invisible, it leaves no traces, that people are becoming themselves computerized. So then, of course, they're not recognizing the ill effects of computerization
Yeah.
because
Well,
they're
they're
just,
hostages to it anyway.
yeah. Yeah, well, that's another way of putting it, which is more true. But I mean, their experience wouldn't be as hostages necessarily. They might just they're joining the thing that they can't beat. Like people, they don't feel they're being coerced into Facebook. They think that Facebook is improving their lives.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So, and it's very well, it's very
Well, it's
insidious.
tragic, and one of the main components of a liberal education until a few decades ago was inculcating people with the notion that life is tragic. And by that, I mean not that everything has a bad ending, but that there are consequences to the things that we do. That in the real world, we're not let, you know, and the real world does not operate on the law that anything goes and nothing matters. And that, unfortunately, is where we are now in Western culture, is that anything goes and nothing matters, especially in economics, stuff.
So that's well, there's two things there. There's the delayed consequence thing. This is something Theodore Dalrymple writes about very well, which is that what people most want is freedom from consequences. And since there is no such thing as that, because everything has consequences, then the best way that society can conspire with the individual to provide this, illusory dissociative techno narcissist fantasy realm is just by delaying the consequences as long as
Yeah,
possible.
or fobbing them off on other people.
I had another point, but I've gone into contemplative mode. I was thinking about when you were talking about the economy and the capitalism and how it gets a bad rap because due to faulty understanding that since I've actually become a capitalist in recent years in the sense of an acting capitalist, as opposed to we're all part of a capitalist system, running a thrift store. And I feel as though it's the most honest work I've done, and I'd include writing with that. And a big part of that, well, there's at least two things. One is that, back to this human connections, is it obliges me and also allows me to have these daily human connections, into relating with the community in a way that is difficult but fruitful. And the other thing is, it's a very straightforward, tangible experience of how to relate to capital, how to relate to objects. Essentially, we take donations, which is can be very demoralizing because people bring all kinds of crap and it never ends. And it really is. It's not easy work, Jim. And it's particularly for somebody who likes to think of himself as a writer just working away on his masterpiece. It's quite galling, on a daily basis. But
That's how I
it's
felt when I was driving a cab.
right. Right. But it does feel as though this is close to an optimal kind of arrangement as far as how to relate to capital, how to have a working system. It's basically exchange. I mean, we get the
Yeah, it's
stuff for free.
transactional.
Yeah, we just charge a service fee. We sell everything as cheap as possible because we just want to get rid of it. And people, obviously the people who give it, they don't want it. It's junk to them. But people come in and it's not junk to them. They want it. So it's redistribution of wealth. And we're just presiding over that. And it's possible to imagine from that removing the money element entirely. It's not a million miles away, because basically we just need food and rent, and there's very limited things we need. So if you imagine it as, and I'm definitely not a socialist or anything, but it might have parallels with socialism as it's, the idealistic view of it, that a community could exist in this way just on the basis of exchange. So that, I'd say, is something close to capitalism free of racketeering.
Well, it's
That,
straightforward, plain, uncomplicated, and honest.
yeah.
There's nothing sinister or underhanded about it, and I could understand why anybody would feel okay about it. But it's not the same as selling mortgage-backed securities to pension funds out of Goldman Sachs,
Right.
especially when you're doing it with pension. When you're selling mortgage-backed securities full of mortgages that no one will ever pay, and you know
Right.
it.
So this system that I can't even understand has become so convoluted and complex that I can't even really understand it.
Well, I think one of the reasons it's happened is because the true, honest, transactional elements of our economy are fading away. We're losing them. And, there's a shrinking pool of wealth out there to transact in, and more people every day who need to transact in it. And so the net effect of that is that people will be forced to cut corners and find ways that are not straightforward and ways that are dishonest in order to get access to whatever capital is out there.
I'm wondering if that's a chicken or an egg question, though, because if you think of just capital in its most basic fundamental sense, as in food and water and shelter and whatever else basic needs, it seems as though that isn't diminished. I mean, there is sufficient there. There's certainly more than enough stuff in our town to, we have to throw half of it away.
Yeah, well, that's stuff that exists now, and it's ca you know, if you're talking about just used stuff, other people's old used stuff, that stuff that was created with earlier capital. The problem now is that the main kind of capital that we depend on, which is the energy capital that creates all that stuff, is dwindling in one way or another. It doesn't appear to be by the sheer quantity, for example, the sheer quantity of shale oil that's coming out of the ground in Texas. However, it is diminishing and dwindling in the sense that the cost of getting it out of the ground is growing, and the return on the investment from it is shrinking, and it's a significant problem for us. And I think it's one of the things that's making our economy not work and driving people to the kind of desperate behavior that you're seeing.
All right, well, let's possibly end on, or at least touch on anyway, the peak oil thing, because I'll give you some personal background on this. I don't know much about peak oil. My wife is more into it. It's my wife who introduced me to your work. And at regular intervals, my wife and I have an argument about the way the world is going. And I'll reduce it to simple terms. I'm very pessimistic in that I feel that the progress of techno-narcissism, as you call it, transhumanism, is kind of unchecked, and we seem to be heading for a very, very dark dystopian future in which human beings will just become completely unmoored from their physical reality and just trapped in some hideous limbo realm. That's kind of my dreadful prospect for the future. My wife is always arguing, no, it's never going to happen because the oil's going to run out.
Yeah, I'm kind of on her side in the sense that, I think there are so many things that the techno-narcissists don't take into account, but one of the more obvious ones is, they have all these fantasies about running all of this, computerize this and computerize that and robotic brothels and, automatic self-driving cars and intelligent highways and blah, 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 blah. But you almost never hear them discuss the fact that the electric grid is tremendously fragile, especially the North American one, and that we don't have any reason to believe that we're going to have reliable electric service in 10 or 20 years. And in fact, I would come down on the side that says that we're probably going to have tremendous problems with it. So I tend to think that a lot of these fantasies that we're having, and some of which are very dark and sinister, are not going to come to pass. And that is exactly the reason that I wrote the World Made by Hand series of novels, to introduce to people the idea that, in fact, we were going to be living in a very different future than many of the advertisers of the future are saying.
That's my niece's fervent wish, and she's only 20 or so, and she hasn't read The World Made by Hand, but I've told her about them, and she would love to go back to that time, and I'm in sympathy, but I take pains to remind her that if we were to go back to that time, there'd be a very, very difficult transition period before
Exactly,
we got there.
exactly. And that's the catch, is that the journey from where we're at now to where we may end up landing is going to be a pretty harsh journey. And it brings up an awful lot of extremely unappetizing prospects. The falling population. However that occurs, it's likely that there's going to be some very unpleasant elements to it, that when the usual suspects, in quote, come to trim the population. It's not something that I want to particularly belabor, but it's part of the picture. And I think it is going to be a harsh journey, and that's why I called it the long emergency in that particular book. And I think that's where we're headed. I'm actually rather cheerful because I don't think that we're going to be subject to the kind of computerized dystopian Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of outcome to all this. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, you're an optimist.
In a way, I am. I am an optimist. I think what we're looking at is what will turn out to be a time out from the industrial technological adventure.
I do tend to believe that too, but I have a perhaps a more metaphysical hope, I think, rather than I wouldn't want to put all my shares in a peak oil scenario just because I just fear that the social engineers may have trump cards we don't know about, no pun intended. But I do feel that there's just something built into the human psyche or the human existence that if we get too far estranged from our souls, then we just can't. We run out of time. That's it. Something intervenes at that point, whether it's nature or whether it's God.
Well, I agree with you completely. And in fact, I have run out of time this afternoon because I have to go on a mission to actually to go to a friend's house and scan a contract that I have to send out.
I was hoping for a much more romantic mission, Jim, just changing your chickens or something that would fit much better with the narrative.
I don't have to change the diapers on the chicken. Thank God.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen.
That's the end of my conversation with James Howard Kunstler for the Limitless, the podcast between. If you don't know already, I also had a conversation with Jim for his Kunstler cast, preceded this conversation. You can find that over at Jim's website, which is linked in the show notes. Next week will be a Halloween podcast with Ken Ami, the researcher into high strangeness. Well, I didn't do it for Halloween, but it's timed perfectly with Halloween, so I'll probably just do the full 2-hour-plus special for Halloween. It's been a bit of a Limitless tradition. After that, I believe it will be a podcast with Douglas Valentine, the author of Phoenix Program and other works. If you want to support this project, this podcast, you can do so by donating, if you like, or by buying any of my books. That's in the widget bar at horticulture.com, any page except the homepage. If you'd like to contact me for a consultation. Okay, I think that's about it. This is Jason Halsey again for the Limitless, for the podcast between.
Anymore. These words, these words are yours. These words are yours. From when you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only one voice. Speak with only one voice.